just a rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free
Hello. Your mind. Welcome to episode 7 of Songs of Freedom. We're back.
Hi, everyone.
It's Matthew Boland and Leanna Fernandez, and we are here to talk about 2014, a new year since the last time we recorded, and there's actually been a lot of stuff going on, both in the world of protest songs and politics and music. And where do you want to start? Because I think one of the biggest things that's happened probably has been a lot of things music-related as it revolves around the conducted Sochi Olympics.
And sports in general. I mean,
yeah.
Also the World Cup coming up.
That's true. Yeah. We'll have links to a couple of articles that talk about protest songs that were either written in reaction to the Putin government's stance against homosexuals and how that affected or in some ways didn't affect what happened to the lead up in the happenings in Sochi, and then also the fact of the World Cup coming up in Brazil, in which a big, well, unfortunately, because it's been underreported, at least in the U.S. media, sort of a behind the scenes working in which a lot of people are getting displaced from poor communities in order to build incredibly large stadiums that may or may not get used again after the World Cup. And there's actually been some protest music that's been written about that. So we'll have a couple articles directly speaking to that that I'm going to put up in the links area. But anyhow, one of the things that you had brought up was just interesting, was the fact that, yes, there is protest music that's being created about world events that we easily have access to because of YouTube and other things like that. But one, is it effective? And two, is it really any good?
Right. So one of the links that Matthew will be posting is a collection of music taken from the internet, extrapolated from the internet. A lot of which I think comes from Global Post, if I'm not mistaken. Where they have, they've just collected a bunch of what they consider to be the best protest songs in reaction to Sochi. And what struck me as really, really interesting is Matt sent me this link, and basically the trajectory that I followed as I was listening to this music. So the first thing I started off with was this one song called Sochi.
Mm-hmm.
Which was done by a Pennsylvania-based band, and it's, we'll call it racy. It was it's a song in which, to quote the article, they took a page from the Dan Savage playbook and redefined Sochi as a verb, which basically means, Well, we'll leave it to your imagination. And also the video, which is quite an eyeful. But anyway, so this song is, you know, it's a dance song. It's a disco song.
Mm-hmm.
And as humor, it struck me as it was definitely very funny. And I also just liked the idea of a club song that takes this issue and turns it on its, pun intended, ass.
Yeah.
And then as I'm listening to this, I'm like, you know, I just want to I just want to listen to something that reminds me, you know, some good club music.
Right.
So now, I remember reading recently about the Communards and Bronski Beat and Ian Somerville and, you know, a good blog about that. And so then I start listening to some Bronski Beat and Wait and stuff like that. Now I'm just going, this is awesome. This is what I... And, you know, from there you could take it to the Pet Shop Boys. And I'm thinking of this rich history of music that I'd never really considered protest music before.
Right.
And yet has always been there and will say maybe lay down the foundation for something like what, or even Erasure, if you're going to go that route, for what I heard in that particular song, Sochi. Sochi being definitely a lot funnier. But still, and you know, maybe I think that the songs that I grew up with and going back to the Pet Shop Boys and Erasure, those songs were more pervasive. Maybe because they weren't so issue specific. I mean, 20 years from now, maybe no one will know what Sochi is. Or maybe someone will only remember it as an afterthought. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't really know. But I just... it just got me thinking to the quality of the music that really defined this issue in the 80s.
Yeah, and I think one of the things about... actually, a couple of things about 80s music as it revolved around politics. And some songs were just really, really overt, like the English Beat with Step Down, Margaret. There's absolutely no reading between the lines.
Stand Down, yeah.
Yeah. But there were also other ones, especially when you were having to deal with issues of sexuality and homosexuality in particular, where it was a matter of trying to use symbolism and metaphor sometimes, or phrasing which is not so overt, reading between the lines. And so those who knew or of, you know, had attachments to a particular culture or were aware of the background of the performers or things like that and their political stances and their social stances or things like that, they got one message and perhaps somebody else got a message, but the, you know, usually the message ended up being dispersed and it wasn't so, like you said, with the Sochi thing, it is really in your face. And I think things like Bronski Beat, it really wasn't as much in there. Or Relaxed by Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely. No, I do agree with that. Very much so. But it depends on the song as well.
Yeah.
You know, definitely if you're looking at Bronski Beat, no, it was certainly not as in your face.
Yeah.
But... yet sometimes it could be, or on the rare occasion that it was, it could be very powerful.
Right.
I'm thinking specifically of, in the case of Bronski Beat, the Communards, it's Small Town Boy is a great example of
that.
But even, I mean, you know, even when it was subtle, it, and I'm going to repeat that phrase I used earlier, turned it on its ass. I mean, think about the Elvis Presley covers. Think about Pet Shop Boys covering You Were Always on My Mind, and
then later
Don't Leave Me This Way, if you're thinking about Ian Somerville event again.
And then later on, the Pet Shop Boys, and what I think is their best album, I think it's not Please, it's the one with the CD had an orange cover that looked like a Lego.
I can't remember the
name. But they did it with a very straight ahead, not flamboyant, serious cover of Go West.
Exactly.
And that was about not even changing any of the words. And the only thing that was like really related to the original song in a way, besides the fact that it was a cover of it, was that they had sort of like that village people call and response background that they sort of left in with this group of men going, I love you. How could I disagree? I want you. You know, so they, but that, you know, it meant a whole lot different. In terms of the meaning of it when it was recorded in 1991, I think, versus like when the Village People recorded it back in like 1978 or 79. You know, now we were dealing with the role of AIDS, and that particular album actually has a lot of things about it that, once again, uses metaphor in order to talk about the AIDS era. The same album had a song called Dreaming of the Queen, in which there are no... The repeated phrases, there are no lovers left alive.
No, they're probably referencing Section 28.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about those songs also is that they also speak to gender and who gets to record a love song about whom.
Yeah, that's true. That's true as well. And one of the other things that I know the Pet Shop Boys did occasionally was, it was the same thing actually that came out of lyrically a very same type of writing style in a lot of ways as Elvis Costello, because it would take the political and the sexual and it would basically turn them around. Like, I mean, for instance, with Elvis Costello, his album, like the entire album, this is the one after this year's Model. It's the one with Oliver's Army on it.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I remember about it was, one, you know, he had a song like talking about relationships called Two Little Hitlers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he had, you know, he had things like using Green Shirt as a title of a song, which I think Green Shirt and Brown Shirt both meant something in terms of... In fact, the original title of the album, before he changed it, there was going to be Emotional Fascism.
Oh, wow.
That's exactly how much he was into the idea that the political and the sexual were linked. And the thing that reminds me of it in the Pet Shop Boys, their one number one song in America, they're basically their second single, West End Girls,
mm-hmm.
is as much of a political song as it is a, you know, a song about, you know, bad boys and good girls and the right side of the thing and the wrong end of the tracks, things like that. Because, and I'll pull up, I'm going to try to pull up the lyrics, but the thing that struck me is they use these particular lines in the song, and here we go. You've got a heart of glass or a heart of stone. So now
they wait till they get you.
Yeah, so they're referencing perhaps the Blondie song in the first one, and then Heart of Stone has been used a lot in relationship songs. Just you wait till I get you home. We've got no future, we've got no past. Here today, built to last. In every city and every nation, from Lake Geneva to the Finland station, how far have you been? Now, interesting why they use these two. A song about the West End and the East End of London, and they're using Lake Geneva and the Finland station, which are two things which aren't in Britain. They're in the Baltics. And significantly, I took a look at you know, in Wikipedia, Lake Geneva was a place where Lenin lived during his exile before the Russian Revolution.
Wow.
And the Finland station was the station just inside of Russia that he arrived at in his return during the revolution.
Wow.
So basically what it comes down to is you've got these things with...
Raise a glass for intelligent dance music.
You've got this situation where you've got the Pet Shop Boys singing about these relationships which are spoken of in these almost violent terms as such, about these poor boys and these rich girls from these two different areas of London, and attaching it in the last line of the last verse to the exile and return of Lenin prior to and at the point of revolution. And mind you, this was during the midpoint of the last of Thatcher's terms in Britain, when it came out in, I think, 84, like late 84, early 85.
And also at the height of the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
And what they at the time termed the gay cancer.
Right.
So if you're thinking in terms of Holocaust.
Yeah.
That would definitely make a lot of sense, and there's a big tie-in there.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, while being done through a heterosexual glass here, we're talking about something which is more important, which is the fact that in order for these problems to be solved, whatever problem that is that they're referring to, and they're dealing with it on a sexual level, is that perhaps revolution is a necessary in order to deal with this gap between, in this way, sort of the haves and the have-nots. You know, the West End girls could represent the normative, well-off society, and the East End boys could represent something along the lines of not just a poor society, but a society which basically is being ignored because of sexuality, disease, all the things that, you know, go along and sometimes are associated with the poor, but could also...
And also have no future. And yes. Have no past if they're revolutionaries, because they're trailblazing, right?
Right.
So let me ask you a question, bringing it back to modern times and the music of Xochitl. What do you think, and amongst that music that we heard and that we'll be linking to, is there anything that you think harkens to that political background, besides the fact that the Russian Federation is persecuting homosexuality? Did you, in any of those songs, find any particular lyrical content that resonated with you quite the same way? Because I can speak for myself and say I didn't. There was perhaps a couple of songs that were certainly speaking to the rights of gay, LGBT rights. There was Melissa Etheridge with that extremely powerful song that she sang during New Year's Eve, which escapes me right now. But when I think about, for example, the Jeremy Merrick song, and from an artistic standpoint, I didn't think much of the song. I'll just put that right out there, with apologies to Jeremy Merrick fans. Of course the message is poignant, and of course he speaks very powerfully to the struggle of the gay community and of the persecuted, of people who are persecuted for being gay. And he says it in a very straightforward way. I don't hear politics there outside of just, you know, the sadness and, of course, the tragedy of being persecuted.
Yeah.
I don't hear any kind of historical reference. Art aside, it was a powerful lyrical statement insofar as it's very sad to hear about abuse. Mm-hmm. But I don't really see how these songs connect the same way. Connect past and present in the same way, and especially not as in a political context.
Yeah, and one of the things that sort of struck me while going through this and seeing what's the difference in sort of like the YouTube viral age versus the songs we're talking about from the 80s and early 90s. And one of the things that sort of that I came back to was, you know, another Russian group that we had talked about in a previous podcast, which was Pussy Riot.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that of the three women within them who had been put in prison, and two were released as part of this pardoning that Putin did prior to the Olympics to show that Russia's cool or whatnot. But I thought it was interesting that, one, these two particular women then sort of went on this tour, and they were sort of held up. They appeared at, like, a concert at the Barclays Center.
Yes.
To speak, and things like that. And they ended up becoming the face of the group. Meanwhile, back in Russia, a bunch of them were saying, "We are not a band. They are not us. In fact, we no longer consider them really part of the group. We are an artistic collective who uses various means of getting across a political statement."
And they disavowed that.
Yeah.
Following that statement. And furthermore, I believe it was the Village Voice wrote a strong piece criticizing the Barclays Center concert.
Yeah.
Mainly because the concert itself didn't seem to be particularly successful outside of, at least from my recollection of the article, a lot of hipsters applauding to Madonna and Pussy Riot being there and not really having any interest in listening to what they had to say.
Yeah. It's sort of like, we're in favor of whatever it is that you're saying, but we don't really know what you're talking about.
Absolutely not. It's again, it's flavor of the month. It's being wherever there's something to be measured as relevant without really understanding the relevancy.
Right. But the thing that I was getting to was the fact that it basically what Pussy Riot, if it were to label itself, it basically labels itself as artists who on more occasions than not use the aesthetic of punk music and actually punk music itself in order to express itself. And that's the thing that I sort of felt with not punk music, but the idea that a lot of these things that were in the article were the ideas of using music or the format of the protest song in order for people to be able to express the opinion that they were getting across. And it just seemed, for the most part, different than the idea of people who are musicians by trade using their songs in order to project things politically, rather than a lot of people who are political individuals who are using music as a format in which to express the politics. Mm-hmm. It just seems that there's a difference there. And I think that's why possibly, in the real irony, the first thing they actually listed was something which had become viral around the time of the Olympics. And it was a recording that had nothing to do specifically with Sochi, but it was the gay men's chorus doing a version of, I believe, Amazing Grace.
Yeah, that was very...
But that within the context of it being passed around during Sochi had a real uniqueness and additional sense of emotion and almost irony within the lyrics by the context of which it was becoming viralized at this particular point in time. And I think that also speaks to the idea is that you don't need to use a sledgehammer in order to have a protest song. You don't even have to have lyrics that specifically overtly state anything or really seem on the surface to be of a political nature and to have good protest music.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, that piece brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah.
Even just thinking about it in the context of Sochi.
Right. And a lot of it has to do with the reception and the intelligence of the audience. And that's sort of why I feel a bit, not a degradation, but a sort of a downgrading of a lot of these other pieces, because it does seem that, especially in a world where there are so many messages being tossed about, that sometimes you need, or people feel the need, to use like sort of blunt force in terms of the lyrics or in terms of the imagery or whatever it is, how they do things in order to get their point across. So I think if there was anything that I was noticing from that particular article, it was actually the difference between what was sort of being expressed in most of the things that were there versus the way they used to be done in talking about similar issues, you know, 20 to 25 years ago.
It's so interesting because I agree with you, and I do think that there is something remarkable about being able to take music that doesn't necessarily speak to a specific issue.
Right.
It's not issue specific and may even be from another time, and then apply it to an issue, and from that understand the universality of the human rights crisis that is implied by the issue. Maybe that's the beauty of those songs of the 80s, of those dance songs, of those seemingly innocuous songs you could get on the floor and dance to, that defines why the Pet Shop Boys are a legacy. Mm-hmm. Because when you really take a finer look and do what you did and go to Wikipedia, you really see the extraordinary depth of what they were getting at.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, let's contrast that with another song that you sent me to take a look at and listen to, which by far was my favorite of all of the songs that that we're discussing in this podcast. Well, at least the contemporary ones.
Yeah.
I'm Sorry, Neymar. Mm-hmm. And that song is in protest of the World Cup in Brazil.
Right.
And, I mean, there's so much to be said about Brazilian music and just the craft of the music that comes from that country just makes things just so much more melodically beautiful. They could be singing, I don't know, a recipe for milkshakes and I'd probably just sway to it. But that song was an extraordinarily powerful song. It's issue specific. It name drops soccer players. And yet, I feel like I could listen to that 5 years from now and still find it beautiful.
Right.
Now, why do you think that is? I mean, not that you're getting into my head, but if you feel similarly that it's a well-crafted song artistically.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I think one of the things is the focus on the structure of the song itself. I said that one of the problems that I had with the other things is that they're basically, you have a particular message and you're trying to get it across as bluntly. And sometimes when you're, and like I said, the difference between a musician who's using his form of art in order to write songs that are expressing political ideas, the idea of somebody who in a way is an artist wanting to express ideas of political nature and using music as the format, mm-hmm. it's sort of the idea of, okay, here's what I want to express, now let's put it into music. Where the musician sort of comes along and says, I have these ideas, I need to create a song, and then fit those ideas into the song. And I think in what I do with songwriting, I'll have an idea, but there are those who go about, basically it's trying to make one thing fit the other, and they have the knowledge that the way that good songwriting is done differently a lot of times than, say, slam poetry in terms of lyricism. And while one might fit well in terms of the other, in terms of the spoken word, you know, there's a reason why rap lyrics usually have a different structure because of the music. Or sometimes the lack of focus, especially on old school, on music versus the beat itself, and basically trying to put the poetry into the structure. And sometimes I think, you know, with the newer protest songs, if the focus basically is on the protest and not the song itself, then it can become ham-fisted, where you're trying to basically squeeze this message into this music that was sort of secondary towards the idea of being able to use a musical medium to put the message forward. And I think that's why with the Brazilian tune, it ends up becoming more effective, because you're always able to, beyond the lyrics, come back to the song. And so usually when even out of context, the Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter was specifically cognizant and attached to, like, the Vietnam era and the civil rights era at that particular time. Now, once again, it uses imagery that you can apply to other things going on now. But I remember sometime during the Clinton administration, I remember somebody talking about Gimme Shelter, and because things were so different in the world, there wasn't actually much war going on. Uh-huh. There wasn't a lot of stuff like that. They said that the song was no longer relevant. And that was a critic that I thought was really out of touch with the reality of how things come and go. But you could, in a way, say that for different particular times, the meaning of the song becomes not as effective. But the fact of how musically it's constructed and how the lyrics fit into it and the emotional connections that the listener can have because of the blend of those two things. It was a really well done song, even if the lyrics specifically relate to events that are outside of, you know, one's particular world, it can still be an effective and affecting song.
Well, maybe that's why music has been consistently in the United States problematic during presidential campaigns.
Yeah.
I mean, think about Sarah Palin's Little Battle with Heart and Barracuda.
Uh-huh.
But then also think about how successful it was during the Clinton campaign to have Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow playing in the background.
Right.
And consistently we see that, sorry Republicans, but Republican candidates have quite a lot of issues with the music that they choose for campaigns.
Right.
I know that Bruce Springsteen certainly didn't like Born in the USA being hijacked by the Reagan administration.
Right. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact just it's not just that a good percentage of musical artists tend to fall on the Democratic side. Although, you know, besides country artists, there are some, you know, surprising number that actually do vote Republican, which it, considering the fact, you know, if you become wealthy and successful, then a lot of times you become self-preservationist in terms of things like that. So
I'm sure the Tea Party will be using some Clapton songs someday. I don't know.
Yeah. But anyhow, wonderful tonight. but anyhow, the bigger issue with a lot of these things is when candidates are using Born in the U.S. or trying to use Born in the USA or Pink Houses to express America is great means that they don't have any ability to interpret the song.
Right.
And that becomes especially scary when you think that the person who is running for office had to have signed off on it at least, which means that they didn't give enough thought to actually listening to the song, or at least the people who are working for him have no idea what the song really is about. And I think that becomes that ends up becoming a possibly one of the reasons why there are so many more modern songs where, like I said, it does seem like they're trying to hit you over the head with things. So it says,
right,
try using this for your campaign.
Well, you know, if you make a song event specific, at least in that way you kind of safeguard against somebody coming back in 2016 and trying to take your song. It's a very interesting mix and an interesting ratio of artistic craftsmanship to lyrical content in that regard,
right,
and message and the conveyance of message, because yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really mean it when I say that I'm Sorry Neymar could be listened to in 5 years and you might go, oh, yeah, I remember that. I remember when there was a World Cup and that was really unfair.
Well, that's the thing about good art is that sometimes, and especially in terms of the, I've heard some artists say who write politically, is I'm glad to be able to say that the issues I was dealing with in the song are no longer relevant, that those things have been, you know, basically dealt with. But at the same time, if it's a good song, you can at least listen to it and know about the lyrics in a historical context.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, for some reason, it keeps popping in my head, but Help Save the Youth of America by Billy Bragg.
Oh, yeah.
And he name drops Chernobyl.
Right.
And I mean, you could talk about Billy Bragg for days, so maybe best not to. But I mean, I would not consider him amongst, I would not put him in the same category of Bronski Beat. And not just because he obviously plays a different kind of music, but he isn't that subtle.
No.
He really does hit you over the head with issues. But what, you know, what strikes me about a lyric like "and the incident at Chernobyl proves the world we live in is very small" is that if I were hearing that song in 50 years and I didn't know what Chernobyl was, I'd look it up just to see what the hell he was talking about.
Right. And as another example of sort of outlasting the event because of the quality of the song itself, you know, I think that there's so much in Neil Young's catalog that relates to that. I mean, first of all, you know, Southern Man, and then Sweet Home Alabama by Lynyrd Skynyrd, which is a direct response song to Southern Man.
Oh, wow.
They say, you know, they refer to Mr. Young in it, but at the same time, they acknowledge the complexities of the situation by also calling out George Wallace and his supporters.
Huh.
You know, and this is the, you know, the first half of the 1970s. And I defy you to go to any rock concert and not have some guy, you know, shout out Skynyrd at some point. And it's usually either Freebird or Sweet Home Alabama. People still listen to that all the time. It's still on a whole bunch of soundtracks and things like that. And the events that they were talking about have well outlasted. Classic rock stations still play Neil Young's Southern Man. That's one of the ones that are in rotation. Rockin' in the Free World from 1989 makes references specifically to George H.W. Bush and Jesse Jackson, though he doesn't name drop them in it.
Oh, I have to revisit that song.
But he's, the last verse actually is the most overt. I mean, although the fact that you're talking about women leaving babies in garbage cans and things like that, and homeless men and things like that, but then the last verse is, got 1,000 points of light for the homeless man, got a kinder and gentler machine gun hand, got cardboard boxes and toilet paper. He refers to the New World Order, and then he ends it with, got a man of the people, says keep hope alive. That was his speech at the 1988 convention, I believe. Jesse Jackson's speech was keep hope alive. Got fuel to burn, got roads to drive. And so he refers to both of them sort of as two sides of a coin. It's ironic how it's like keep hope alive. At the same time, got fuel to burn, got roads to drive. sort of offsets that, especially when you realize that... Neil Young, like a few years ago, put out a concept album almost totally revolved around this car that he bought, which uses hydroponic fuel and stuff like that. But that's beside the point. The whole concept is that if you have a well done piece of art, it's going to outlast the event that it speaks to if there is specificity within it because of the quality of it. And while the Russian songs, for the various reasons that I've mentioned, probably are not going to be, you know, make it into future books about, like, classic political songs, there could be reference to, at least if you're talking about, you know, American protest music or something like that, there could be reference to I'm Sorry, Neymar in the future because of the quality of the music and the use of the lyrics and the music together and the construction of a good song.
Yeah. I got to do my Neil Young homework. The most I remember is that I'm not singing for Pepsi, I'm not singing for Coke.
Right. He's been all over the spectrum. It's a very interesting thing depending upon. I mean, he originally, I think, supported W, and then he turned against him to the point where he did a whole album. It has songs on it called Let's Impeach the President, and this was during Bush's second term.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, that would be a great theme for another time,
right?
Actually, the Bush presidency and music to come out of that and the Gulf War.
Right.
There was a ton of music
right
that came out of that. Even the Beastie Boys recorded a song in protest of the Gulf War.
The one way I wanted to address that, and we'll get back to the actual issue at hand here, but the one thing that I also wanted to address about that was the fact that, unlike other times where you had these issue songs actually cross over onto the pop charts, the one thing that I noticed, it didn't seem like there were any actual songs which were hitting the Billboard charts that were coming out about these things. And I don't know whether or not it's simply because Clear Channel was, you know, buddies, literally, you know, palling up with George W. Bush, or just the way the music business goes and everything being so sort of streamlined and more middle of the road.
Yeah, but Bright Eyes did appear and sing his song about George Bush, the name of which also escapes me, on the Jay Leno show.
Yeah, well, but there's a difference between being able to sing it on a particular show versus it then becoming a top 40 hit in the nation.
Yeah.
And when I think back to things that, you know, songs in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s which were of a political nature, I don't see that really happening. I see that there are people who are actively involved in politics, but for various reasons, you know, there's not some sort of what I guess you could call crossover between mainstream charts and mainstream radio or whatever you want to call it in terms of how they put the charts together nowadays and these types of songs.
Do you think it's relevant, though? I mean, given the proliferation of music and all other media, really, on the internet?
I don't think it's particularly relevant, simply because, as we've seen from some of the weird-ass stuff that goes on, especially with I think Billboard itself has become less and less relevant. So the idea of charts themselves have become less and less relevant, especially when you're dealing with a situation in which you're having declining album sales and the importance more and more of being able to target specific subgroups. You know, when you're in a world in which a show like Mad Men, which only gets a couple of million viewers per week, dominates things culturally, and if they were on broadcast TV even 10 years ago and had that amount of viewers, they wouldn't make it past the first season.
Absolutely.
You know,
that's
so
very powerful.
That's one of the things about sort of the splintering of culture, is that at the same time that the internet has both split culture into little groups, but at the same time made those smaller groups more important because they're sort of targeted resources, or however you want to label them. That's sort of a advertisement type of label that I give. But in a way, a lot of things do end up getting targeted. In a way, you are advertising your cause, yourself, things like that. And with these songs, you're sort of, in a way, advertising these movements, or in protesting them to give light to them in a certain way.
Which makes me think about the efficacy of protest music. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, if a Bruce Springsteen records 41 Shots, it's going to get a bit more airplay because it's Bruce Springsteen, and a little more coverage on the nightly news for it being Bruce Springsteen. But right. In a future when our media is so splintered and divisive, even, I would say, because of the proliferation of the internet, I wonder if even really powerful songs like the ones we've just discussed, like this Brazilian World Cup song, would ever have the power to bring people together and organize to the degree that they did in past decades.
I think they may be able to bring them together. My worry is that it brings them together for the wrong reasons. Do you remember the viral video by this guy Tay Zonde a few years ago called Chocolate Rain?
No, I don't.
This guy who looks like sort of like a mixture of Charlie Brown and Urkel.
Okay.
I'll show it to you.
Having trouble with it, but
I'll show you when you're done. But he put out this song, and he also has a voice like this. You know, it's just like the guy looks like he's like forever stuck in like 14 or 15 years old or something like that.
And all right.
Like he should be playing Dungeons and Dragons, and instead he's got like a voice deeper than Barry White's coming out, and he's got this song, Chocolate Rain. Baby dies before it comes. And all anybody, it got millions and millions of hits. He got like an offer for a commercial from Dr. Pepper and stuff like that. All anybody could talk about was the fact that he goes, look at this guy and how he looks and his voice. And just Chocolate Rain. And they sort of overlooked the fact that it was basically him singing about, by the Chocolate Rain, it basically talked about sort of like the intense weight of suffering that's been dropped down on blacks throughout their history.
And
yeah. And so without the, somebody actually took the song and he put it to a, as a backdrop to a montage that he put together of things from slavery to the civil rights era and stuff like that. And it hits you over the head at that particular point. But the thing is that, that's once again, comes back to the original thing, is I think that some people are worried. And while I don't think it makes for effective songwriting, depending upon how the song construction is done, one of the problems is if you write a catchy tune, some people may just be focusing on not getting the real message in the same way that these Republican candidates were not getting what Born in the USA and Pink Houses and other things
were
about.
Well, in the case of Chocolate Rain, without having seen that video, it strikes me as almost cruel that you would divorce the two and choose to focus on this guy's appearance when he's singing about something so heavy.
Mm-hmm. And also it goes back to the thing, you know, like you start to worry about how much subtlety can modern generation actually handle.
Exactly. And that's why I go back to this argument that I'll even posit that I just don't know that any music really, but especially protest music, can have the efficacy that it used to.
Yeah.
It doesn't hit you the same way no matter how beautifully crafted it is. Because if it's hitting you in this viral way on the internet, along with every other video that you've been played on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
it's not Pete Seeger singing to you at a cafe in the village, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a very different context and hits you in a very different way than things do right now.
Yeah.
And I feel terribly pessimistic saying that.
No, I totally understand where you're coming from with that, and I agree to a real extent because, you know, as a librarian, I look at sort of like the wave of like, well, everything's going to go to an e-reader, and the you know, once again, it's one of these times where it says paper is doomed and things like that, and why would you, you know? And they say, why would you do that if you'd be wasting, you know, saving trees and all that type of thing? And it comes back to various things. It's about two things. Who controls the message? And how is your brain as the interpreter dealing with the message?
Right.
Now, the two things here is that, first of all, when you have something electronic, you're dealing with a license instead of a purchase most of the time. So even if you buy, quote-unquote, something for your Kindle, you've basically signed an agreement with Amazon or Barnes & Noble or the publisher or whoever it is to do certain things with it. And to, if it's not something that's a subscription service, so that you don't constantly have something that's being the terms changed on you and stuff like that. Actually, even if you do buy it outright, you do enter into an agreement with licensing where they can change things on you.
Uh-huh.
And so the idea of control becomes very focused, the same way that like Clear Channel focused, you know, what type of music we were getting on the radio, what type of messages we were getting on the radio. And the other thing is that the brain responds differently depending upon what the medium is. And if you're reading a book, the brain acts differently than, say, if you're watching television. And if you're looking at a computer screen, your brain, especially in generations which have grown up, you know, dealing with television, you sort of have it sort of ingrained in you that you're responding to it differently than you're like, paper? Computer. So to carry that back into the idea of music is, you know, if you're going on YouTube and you're getting songs and now streaming is being done by, you know, if you can basically like watch a bunch of videos of people dancing and make Harlem Shake a number one song based upon the rules that they're constantly changing in Billboard in order to find some way in the digital age to accurately portray what is the biggest thing going on in music.
Right.
Then not only has the medium changed, but the way in which our consumption and our relation to it and how our brains are even functioning in consuming this thing has changed. So the idea of like these subtle, well-crafted songs, you know, because there are so many ways about being able to digest the songs now, both through our ears and our eyes and who knows how else in the future.
Yeah.
It really does make you question in terms of this protest music that's now coming out and what we've basically, you know, been speaking about for nearly the last 45 minutes or so is how good and effective are these things at doing what they're meant to do, and how much does it particularly matter to the person who's doing it if the most important thing is basically just get the point out there and get it across and then basically hope that it gets passed around enough that it becomes viral or something like that. Does it matter quite as much how well crafted the messages or how well it fits into the music bed or the song's arrangement? I don't know. I know that the thing is that I don't know art, but I know what I like, but I kind of think I know kind of good art as well. And
I do. I would like to think the same. I would like to think that there's a very good reason why the protest songs of a different era stand out to us.
Yeah.
And it's not just because of how we received them,
mm-hmm.
but because they were good.
Yeah.
Because they were well crafted, because they're beautiful pieces of art. If not, everybody who ever walked into Cafe Wa would be famous, and I'm not sure they are.
Right. And that's why it comes back to the conflict that I have between people who I feel are artists working in a musical medium and musicians who are using their art to be able to state a certain type of message.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things, you know, we started out in 2014, and we ended up going all over the place, because I think that as music lovers and as lovers of politics and, you know, being really fascinated by protest music and its history and things like that, you sort of worry about the direction it's sort of going in, is if this is what these times are, for the most part, seem to be producing. Now, mind you, they can't also produce something like the Brazilian song.
Exactly. Exactly. Just like the 80s could, and I definitely am amongst those people who hate the terms intelligent dance music, but I can understand where that comes from.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because it's that kind of, I don't know if the term is cognitive dissonance, between being able to dance your ass off,
right,
to a song, and it, which is some an act we associate with frivolity, with lightness, with joy, and certainly with a certain kind of, certainly not gravity, and yet you can write so poignantly within that context. And you know, we don't think of it as protest music. That's the beauty of it, in a way, is that we can listen to those songs and regard them as a lot of fun, and then have, you know, become a little bit more circumspect of the activities we might have done to them, know, when they were playing at a time. And I think that that is very much something I associate with the 80s.
Yeah.
Not so much with the 90s and Cobain and, you know, Vedder and anything that came out of that time, though.
No, and I think even in the 70s, especially when you're talking about a thing like disco, which was really strongly influenced by these underground cultures and by minority cultures and gay culture and things like that, and for the most part had strong negative reactions from a lot of white population. It was like the dirty secret until sort of Saturday Night Fever exploded it. And so suddenly then people reacted against disco. It was sort of like they reacted against the Bee Gees. And then, so disco's dead, the Bee Gees for the time being were dead, and then all the important stuff about disco for a lot of the mainstream population, you know, sort of went back. It remained underground.
Well, so, I mean, you know, I think of so much of the 70s as being reactionary to the late 60s.
Yeah.
And the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
And all of the different things that happened during that time that didn't quite go the way they were supposed to.
Yeah.
Politics remained politics as usual. The Vietnam War continuing despite protest into the 70s.
Right.
I think that people either became escapist or they, and that is reflected, I think, in the music of the time.
Yeah.
And then they went the whole other direction, and they went the direction of punk rock.
Punk was sort of in your face, and the message and the music, they were hitting you over the head, but they're also hitting you over the head with the music and the thing. So they went together. So that's why really good punk rock really, really worked.
And also the iconography of punk rock and how people behaved. I mean, you can't really separate Iggy Pop from his stage antics.
Yeah. On the other hand, you had a lot of disco music in which it was, you were actually addressing some of the issues in terms of it, but a lot of times you're addressing it in terms of an idea of self-empowerment. And so in a way, if the issues were being addressed, you were sort of, if there are problems, you went to the club to basically escape that, and if it came in, you basically sort of danced the problem away, at least temporarily.
Right.
And actually, really, that was kind of the message of Saturday Night Fever and the article that it was based on. But it was basically, it was about the culture of Saturday night. In New York, and basically these people escaping, instead of possibly racism or you know, anti-gay sentiment and stuff like that, they put it into the form of you know, an Italian guy who didn't like his shitty job and stuff like that. But it was a representation of things that were, you know, going on, and what the disco era sort of represented for those people. But still, there is some sort of definition that I don't know the same type of thing as crystal clear for 2014 so far.
And that's the other thing, is that there's no set kind of music that defines the era.
Right.
So if you want to say there was a folk renaissance in the 60s and disco renaissance in the 70s and, I don't know, minimalist pop new wave was the 80s.
Yeah.
What defines, and even grunge in the 90s, but then as soon as we get to the aughts, there's this kind of disconnect between defining any era with a particular type of sound. That, of course, is something you could attribute to the internet as well, and the fact that that splinters people. And
exactly. And I think if you could come to some sort of conclusion as to what we've been saying, is that, as we discovered recently, there is protest music that is coming out, but in terms of any sort of expansiveness of it or varying levels of song quality and focus and the difference between bluntness and subtlety and all the things that go to construct not just a good protest song, but good songs in general, because good protest songs usually are simply good songs as well. I think we're sort of still in that transitional period where, between technology and in terms of the audience and in terms of splintering things and in terms of the idea of having to pound your message in order to get it across and things like that, and the idea of the artist working in the medium versus the musician who is using their defined medium to express it, I think we're in between a lot of things right now. And I'd like to see, as the year goes on, if any of that ends up changing, if there becomes anything that we can recognize as being a refocus or sharpening in terms of that.
Yeah, I would really like to see some very well-watched sporting event, such as the World Cup or a Super Bowl or something of that nature, be thrown off by some unexpected musician just going to town with a message.
Yeah.
I mean, when I think about, and I know we're probably should be wrapping up, but think about MIA's performance and think about how much Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction had to do with everything that came afterwards and how we still can remember stupid things like this.
Yeah.
I think that there's a potential for a song to be incredibly powerful, to hit a major amount of people if there's high viewership and the content and the timing is right. The context, I mean, I think the circumstances are much more difficult.
Right.
But I think that there's still, I mean, thinking about that particular scenario, wouldn't that be ideal? Wouldn't it be ideal if a wonderfully crafted song were to somehow infiltrate the airwaves, or I don't know, some place where people could really, really see it and it could go viral.
Yeah.
That would be something.
Yeah, I agree with that. And on that note, we're going to wrap up episode 7 and promise you that episode 8 will actually come quite shortly, especially in comparison to the length of time between 6 and 7. So signing off for now, this is Matthew Bolin and
Leanna Fernandez
saying thank you very much and have a good night.
Bye, everyone. In Europe and America, there's a growing feeling of hysteria, conditioned to respond to all the threats and the rhetorical speeches of the Soviets. Mr.